I'm Jeremy Loeb with WCQS News. Coming up is an interview with Senator Jim Davis, a Republican of Franklin, who represents a district encompassing seven western North Carolina counties. Davis is in his fourth term. Thanks for coming back. I really appreciate having you here and your willingness to come in and talk.
Certainly, Jeremy. I'm delighted to be here and to offer my insights into the new legislative session.
I'm sure the faces come and go and they change a little bit, but do you expect any differences?
Not really. I'm sure the main change happened when the Republicans gained control of the General Assembly, and I was part of that in the election of 2010, and so we took office January 2011. And so I'm sure that the people were there prior to January 2011 would be able to give you a lot more insights on how things changed, but they haven't changed that much. Some of the players have, but not many.
Well, for our listeners who haven't gotten a chance to know you over the years, even though you've been there for a while, could you just tell us a little bit about your background and how you got going into politics?
Well, I've always been interested in politics, and I served as a county commissioner in Macon County for a total of 10 years. I was there from 96 to 2000, and then 2004 until 2010 when I was elected to the Senate.
Okay. And your background is you're an orthodontist.
That's correct. You know, I've been in dentistry for 42 years now. I just turned 70, and I'm married. Just celebrated our 44th anniversary in December.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And that my wife deserves those congratulations. It's far more than I.
Do you have any kids?
I have two sons. They're 39 and 40, and my older son is married, and he has two daughters, 15 and 12.
Okay. And what got you going into orthodontics?
Well, I started out in general dentistry. I practiced general dentistry for 13 years and then had a midlife crisis. And when I was 40 years old and I didn't need a red sports car, and I loved my wife, and so I decided to go back to school and took orthodontics. And it's a far less stressful than general dentistry, and I get to work puzzles all day. And so I really enjoy that.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, you work with kids, and of course with kids, you know, when they're getting their braces, you know, you see them over a long period of time, you get to know them for a little bit.
Oh, you get to watch a lot of them mature and grow up and change and develop personalities. It really is a lot of fun, and you have a great opportunity to impact their lives, not only in straightening their smiles, but to see them develop as young people.
Yeah, and you witness them, you know, right in the beginning when they're really nervous, I guess, about braces, about how they're going to feel, how they're going to look, and everything.
Yeah, and that's true. And I probably caused them as much pain as I did in general dentistry, but their perception of it is less. So
yeah,
and
yeah.
they're more motivated segment of the population. So it's a fun profession.
Okay, so
I still practice actually Monday mornings and all day Friday.
Oh, okay, and you'll keep doing that during session.
Yeah, the legislative salary is not very lucrative, and so. My wife and I still enjoy eating, and so I have to keep working.
Yeah. You were telling me before we went on microphone that, you know, we were asking you about the drive, and you've got, I guess, you know, among the longest drives over to Raleigh that you'll be doing twice a week, I guess.
Yes, 315 miles each way.
Yeah.
From Franklin to Raleigh, and so that's what they pay me for, is 630 miles round trip.
Did you grow up in Franklin?
I did not. I'm a native Virginian.
Okay.
I was born in Lynchburg, Virginia. My dad was in the Navy in World War II, and then he made the Air Force a career after the war. And so we spent about four different tours at Langley Air Force Base, Virginia. And we were in Arizona, Tucson, Arizona, and Selfridge Air Force Base in Michigan, Dover, in Delaware, and then a real exciting tour in Nuasu Air Force Base near Casablanca, Morocco, and then 2 years in England at Weathersfield Air Force Base. So it was a great life.
And this was all before you turned 18?
Yes. Yes,
oh, okay.
This was all before, you know, actually we got back from overseas when I was 15.
Was it lonely for you, or was it interesting? You got to meet new people, but it was, I guess, hard to, you know, keep relationships over time.
Well, I had a big family, and so I had those relationships. And my father was—he finished seventh grade, and he was really one of the smartest guys I ever knew. But he just didn't have the opportunity for education. But he was a very adventuresome soul. It was all over the Pacific, the South Pacific, in World War II, and he just loved traveling. And so when we were in Morocco, for example, we would take off for the weekends and go to the Atlas Mountains, or go to Marrakesh, or Erfurt and Asru and McNez and, you know, Fez. And then when we were in England, we'd instead of when we the squadron was being deactivated, actually the King of Morocco was phasing out American bases in his country. And so we still had 2 years left of a 3-year overseas term. And so instead of shipping everything, my dad, we hopped in a 55 Chevrolet and we drove to Tangier and took the ferry across to Gibraltar and drove all through Europe. My dad just dragged us all over the place, and probably sometimes we didn't really appreciate it like we should have, but over time we've come to really appreciate that opportunity, and it made us, I have two younger siblings, and made us all easily adaptable, you know, regardless of what, you know, what kind of a situation or position you put us in, and able to meet new people. And so I think that was a great life. I really appreciate my dad and for my mother for going along too.
That's quite a worldly perspective that you get to bring to the legislature as well.
It is. When I was in a freshman in college, my roommate had a car and really nice clothes and stuff. And like I said, Sergeant Davis, he made a lot of sacrifices, he and my mother, to help us go through school. And I told my roommate one time I really envied him, you know, in a kind way, that he had a nice car and nice clothes and stuff like that, and I didn't have. And he just looked at me and he said, "You're crazy." I said, "I envied you. You've been everywhere." Those experiences really enrich people, and they've enriched me, and I'm very thankful for it.
And forgive me if you already said this, but when did you end up in Franklin?
I moved there right out of dental school in 1974. My wife and I moved there in June of 74, and so I was there from June of 74 until 87. I went back to school in a graduate program in orthodontics in 87 and moved back to Franklin in 89. And so I've been there ever since.
So you obviously love Franklin a lot.
Yes,
You've been there.
It was a great place to live.
Yeah. Tell me about your district. You represent quite a few counties out there in the West.
Yeah, 7 counties. And I have Bill Cook, who has Senate District 1, is the eastern part of the state, and he claims to have the largest landmass, but I tell him if I flatten mine out, it would be far larger than his. But
yeah,
I have 7 counties, Haywood and everything west, and I'm actually closer to 4 other state capitals than my own.
So tell me a little bit about your beliefs and what kind of motivates you politically, you know, whether it's spiritual or those types of things.
Well, I think politically, I'm a physical conservative. I'm really a social libertarian when it comes to philosophy. But personally, I'm very conservative socially, but I don't feel like I have the right to impose my beliefs on other people, so long as they don't endanger public safety and public welfare. I think that's important. We need to guard those. But I'm largely a social libertarian, just in, you know, let people do what they want, just don't hold society accountable for the costs associated with that. But
right.
I'm a physical conservative. I'm very disturbed at the national debt, the legacy that we're leaving those behind us, our kids and grandkids, I think is unconscionable. And we're spending far more money than we have, and far more money than those behind us can ever repay. Mm-hmm. And it greatly concerns me. And it's one of the reasons why I'm very thankful for our service in North Carolina. We're living without our means, and we're making a dent in the unfunded liabilities that we have dealing in North Carolina. So I'm very proud of that.
What are some of the challenges you think are faced by your constituents?
Well, in the western part of the state, it's, you know, the economy and jobs, like it is a lot of the country. We have our road system, even though it's good, it's restrictive in some regards. You know, like Graham County up where Robbinsville, it's difficult for tractor trailers to meander through those mountains, and they don't have a railroad there, and so that makes it difficult to attract big industry, you know, that's stable. We've enhanced the business environment out there. I was in the Senate when we allowed the Eastern Band to go live dealers, for example, in their casino, in their gaming industry, and I think that increased their revenues about $80 to $100 million the first year. Later on, they built a second casino over in Murphy and added about another 1,000 jobs to begin with, and that will grow. And the live dealers added over 1,000 at the casino in Cherokee. You know, we have the largest manufacturing facility in Haywood County, Evergreen Packaging, the largest manufacturing city west of Charlotte. And they have about 1,200 jobs in the Haywood County region. They have 200 in Raleigh, so a total of about 1,400 jobs. And so we were able to get some grant funding through JMAC and help them to comply with EPA regulations dealing with their coal-burning generators. And we helped them convert those to natural gas, at least two of them, which was a considerable expense. I think the EPA, they've spent over $300 million in the last 20 years complying with federal EPA regulations. And so it makes it difficult for some of these companies to comply with all that. And so we were trying to help them with this approximately $50 million expense in upgrading their boilers. And so this $2 million a year for 6 years, for a total of $12 million, helped them to stay there because they have very, very good paying jobs. I think the average salary there is about $80,000 a year. They have like a quarter of a $1 billion economic impact in the western part of the state. We were very pleased that we were able to keep them there and functioning in Haywood County.
You mentioned roads. You'll be a co-chair of the Transportation Committee in this coming session, so you'll be able to have an impact in that area.
Well, probably. I guess maybe they put me there because I inspect about 630 miles of it every week. You know, look
That's
at
right.
It. But yeah, it's going to be a new challenge. I'm really working hard already to get up to speed. I'm talking to the district engineer and in the western part of the state, and I'll be doing some visiting of roads and projects within the next couple, 3 weeks. I've already met with staff. So it's a steep learning curve.
Yeah.
Fortunately, those chairs that served there before, Bill Rabin and Kathy Harrington, Kathy is now a senior chair with appropriations, and Dr. Rabin, Bill Rabin's a veterinarian, and he is the new rules chair in the Senate. So they've moved on, and they're available for any help. But we're very fortunate, and they have stopped the transfer of about $225 million a year out of the Highway Trust Fund to the general fund. And so the money that's collected for transportation is going to stay in transportation where it never should have been diverted. This last year was the first year we've been able to completely stop that. It's about $225 million a year. And so that money will stay for transportation projects. But all the transportation projects now are rated. We have a committee that looks at them, and they determine, they have a priority scale. You know, it's based on safety and traffic, you know, the volume. It's not based on who your legislator is and how prominent they are, how important they are in the legislature. It's based on the need, and which is where it should be. You know, that's where the priority should be. And so that's really good that we've started that process. And the good news for us, President Trump is talking about a considerable infrastructure spending, you know, from the federal government, as much as $1 trillion. And we're very fortunate from the work that has been done by the past chairs that these projects are prioritized so that whatever money we get from the federal program, we already have these projects prioritized, and we can identify them readily and get to work on satisfying the need.
And how do you feel about the proposal? As you mentioned, you're a fiscal conservative. You're worried about the debt. Is that an area, though, you think spending should be placed in as far as infrastructure?
Well, I think, yes, I do. Yeah. But I think need to be very cautious. Again, debt is debt. Nothing's a good deal if you can't afford it. And I just really am concerned about the incredible debt that we've racked up in our country. And it's a bipartisan, you know, area. Obama has doubled the debt in his 8 years, but no party is immune from participating in that. I'm not an apologist for what the Republicans have done. I think no matter who does it, it's not a good idea.
Do you like the signs that you're seeing from a fiscal standpoint?
Well, it's
It's
pretty early. I like the rumblings that I hear about bringing all the trillions of dollars that we have overseas, and we have the highest corporate tax rate in the industrialized world. And so if we were to lower that like to 15% and repatriate all this money that's overseas and invest it in American products and companies and jobs, I think that our country will be far better off. But I'm just concerned about the debt.
The last time there was a budget approved, it took lawmakers quite a while to agree. There were differences in the House and the Senate. Do you think you guys will be more aligned this time, or do you expect that there may be some issues that arise again?
Oh, I'm sure there will be issues. I'm really proud that, you know, the budget started in the House last time, but the House wanted to spend, I think, around $700 million more than the Senate did, and we held out, and that's why we went from, we were supposed to be done by the end of June, really, for a new budget, and we went till the end of September. Mm-hmm. But we did not spend $700 million more. We put that into savings. And it was very prescient because we needed that money in savings because of Hurricane Matthew and the fires. So we need this emergency funds, and we've appropriated, in December, we appropriated $201 million for that disaster relief, and that's just a down payment. We have more work to do. I think the total loss in North Carolina is estimated about $2 billion.
Wow.
So we need to address those communities and help make them whole, that in combination with federal money.
I was talking to Representative McGrady about this, and you know, we were talking about how the emergency funds that they approved in the special session was a first step. He was saying that it's very likely that most of the needs in Western North Carolina were addressed.
Most of the needs were addressed by?
By the first step, the
emergency
funding.
Well, actually, I think we only lost one private residence in Western North Carolina due to the fires, and that was a cabin up on Wallia Bald in Macon County, owned by a friend of mine, actually, and I think that was the only private residence. You know, the big loss for the fires in the western part of the state was in federal lands, and then over in Tennessee, you know, they had some devastating losses, and where what they lost 14 people,
yeah,
I think. So North Carolina was fortunate they got to escape the majority of the damage, and I've heard foresters say that some of the fires in, you know, in the National Forest was good. I'm not smart enough in that area to know that that's so, but I presume that they are correct, and it wasn't a lot of damage. But the damage around Pigeon Forge and Gatlinburg was just very tragic.
Yeah, so it seems like most of the needs remaining are on the east as far as Hurricane Matthew relief.
I think almost all of them.
Yeah. Okay. Well, what are some of your priorities coming into this session? Obviously, budget. You'll be working on transportation. What are some of the things that you're looking at?
Well, I think we need to continue working on tax reform and regulatory reform. My sense is that there's not going to be much more tax reform this time. I would personally like to see the changes that we've made take effect. Some of the changes we made need to be fine-tuned. If you talk to builders and people in the construction trades, the changes that we've made need some tweaks, and so we need to focus on that to make sure we do the appropriate things in changing those. Mm-hmm. Whenever you do some big changes, invariably you have problems, something that you missed or didn't, unintended consequences, things like that. So we need to do that, but I don't envision any big changes this time like we had last time. I think the House and the Senate are going to be more aligned, and that's probably the result of politics dealing with a Democrat governor. And the House and the Senate is going to push us closer than we were last budget cycle. Like I said, we were, you know, off about $700 million. We'll just have to wait and see what the governor puts together. So I think we need to continue to address pay for state employees, including teachers.
Mm-hmm.
We've made some big strides for our K-12 teachers. And beginning pay, especially, gone from $30,800 to starting out at $35,000. I think the average pay for a K-12 teacher now in the state is about $50,000, and we would like to push that up to about $55,000. We need to address certain parts in education, like principal pay as well. We've got an initiative to reduce class size in K-3. Of course, the biggest determining factor in education is the quality of the teacher, and so we want to do everything that we can to make sure that we have qualified teachers in the classroom. But a smaller class size in those early grades to help ensure that the kids are reading at grade level by the time they finish grade 3 better prepares them for grade 4 and on. You know, the first years you're learning to read, and after that you're reading to learn. So we need to ensure that our young people, our students, are reading at grade level before they are push forward.
Now, I understand that there are some issues with that, some unintended consequences, and some of the school districts have mentioned that they may need to make cuts in other areas like arts, PE, class sizes, and other grade levels. I had Representative Cody Henson, one of the freshman lawmakers in here, talking about hoping to find a remedy for that in the coming session. What do you think about that?
Well, I think when you reduce class size, force them to reduce class size, then you put an additional burden on the local, the LEA. Probably are some unintended consequences with regards to that. Some of our school systems don't have the additional class space or teachers to deal with that. So I think that we need to give the local educational authority the authority to adjust class sizes. You talk to teachers, and some years are, these kids as a group are just angelic. And then you have another year where they're not so angelic. And so maybe the angelic classes don't need, the number of teachers. But we try to treat everybody the same, and it just doesn't work on the local level. So I'm a strong proponent of local government. I think you ought to give the local government more authority, but to hold them accountable. But I've always been convinced that all wisdom and knowledge doesn't emanate from Raleigh.
Yeah.
A lot of incredibly talented people in serving in local government, and we ought to give them the authority to do their job and hold them accountable.
Yeah, and you were a local government guy for
Indeed.
A long time.
And I still use local government people in my own home county and other counties as resources. I talk to them about the legislation that we have, and they know that they can contact me, and I will listen to them because they have a plethora of good ideas and warnings about if you do this, then this will happen. I'm a strong proponent of local government and appreciate them very much.
And having served, with Indeed. The Macon County, you have good relationships with them, I assume.
Yes, and the irony of my wanting to go to state office was to try to stem the flow of unfunded mandates, all mandates, but especially unfunded ones. I thought if it was a good idea from the state, then you ought to fund it.
What did you think of the special sessions that we had recently? We have the hurricane and wildfire relief, and then the gubernatorial powers issues, and then HB2. What do you think about those, I guess, taking them one by one?
Well, the biggest one is probably that's caused more angst than about anything else was HB2. And HB2 was the result of an unconstitutional ordinance by Charlotte. North Carolina is a Dillon's Rule state, and regardless of what you think about that, and I have some problems with a Dillon's Rule state, but nevertheless, that's what we are constitutionally. So local governments get their power and authority from the state. So local government doesn't have the authority to do what Charlotte had to do. And Attorney General Cooper, or he was the Attorney General at the time, he failed to stop Charlotte. And had he done that, then we would not have needed to go into special session to adopt HB2. And people need to understand that the LGBTQ rights are still protected by federal law. And my particular problem, again, I'm a libertarian socially in many regards, so long as you don't endanger public safety and public health. And my problem with the Charlotte Ordinance was the gender identity and gender expression. I don't think gender is a fluid condition. I have no problem. I don't understand gay, lesbian, transgender lifestyle, but I respect people's ability to do that. I've had, those... My sister-in-law was a lesbian, and I have patients that are gay, and I have a transgender, actually, not a patient, but a friend. And so I talk to them about these issues. Mm-hmm. But if gender is fluid, then people could use that for nefarious purposes. And privacy rights, I think, are primary over gender identity and gender expression.
You're actually the only senator that I've had in this latest round of interviews that I've done. So you're there. Where did the breakdown occur? I know Berger was trying to work out this deal. There was a 6-month moratorium offered. What happened behind the scenes that we didn't see?
Well, the Senate caucus, Republican caucus, was divided almost exactly in half. And some senators, I think, and I respect their position, some senators did not want to get rid of HB2 because it protected privacy rights. They were paramount. And I believe that as well. But I also, Senator Berger, our pro tem, had worked out a deal with Charlotte and with the speaker that if we repealed HB2, but stated in that repeal that no local government could address this issue in ordinance for 180 days would give us a cooling off period so that, you know, reasonable people could come together and to find a solution to this issue. And again, it was never, that I know of, about the LGBTQ community. It was about this gender identity and gender expression. That was the pitfall. So Governor Cooper, or then Attorney General Cooper, Governor-elect Cooper, at the last minute, he called because this vote was taking place in the Senate, he called all the Democrat senators and asked them to vote against it. And so that's what they did. And so that's why we didn't repeal HB2. You know, because with the half of the Republicans and all the Democrats, then it would have been repealed. But their sticking point was this 180 days.
Yeah.
You know, no local government could do anything regarding that issue for 180 days. Well, there's no way that I would have voted to repeal HB2 if we didn't have those protections in there.
I see.
You know, we just wanted to reset. Let's come together when cooler heads prevail and look at this issue and try to find a reasonable solution. But I wasn't going to repeal it and then have Charlotte or we had rumblings that Durham or, you know, or other cities. Again, it was just rumors, but we had people telling us that other cities would adopt the same ordinance as Charlotte did.
Mm-hmm.
And so that would have, you know, why would we do that, you know, to repeal HB2 without having the protections that, listen, we're going to have a reset. Let's come together and try to figure out a solution. So that's ostensibly where Governor-elect Cooper was, that he didn't like the last part of that. But for us, that was a protection that we really would have a reset, mm-hmm. and we wouldn't be dealing with this all over again from Charlotte or from any other municipality in this state.
Yeah. It seemed like tempers really flared. Are you hopeful about the next 4 years as far as being able to find a working relationship with the governor, seeing if the Republican leaders and the governor can possibly find some common ground?
Oh, I'm sure we can, you know, but politics is politics.
And yeah.
I tell people I'm kind of a lousy politician. I think I'm a pretty effective public servant. And I think when we get too enamored with politics, that reason goes out the window and we're not able to accomplish good things. And
mm-hmm.
so I think the North Carolinians, the citizens deserve for us to work together and get things done. We have infrastructure. You know, I can't imagine the governor not wanting to increase teacher salaries. There are other things that we can work on, and there are things that we can't, you know, we won't work on. And so we'll have to wait and see what his budget spending is. He's already, you know, wants to expand Medicaid, which he doesn't have the authority to do. And now, since that didn't get done before the end of the Obama administration, that's highly unlikely that that will even be considered. And who knows what's going to happen with the Medicaid expansion and Obamacare with the new administration. We've heard promises, but we don't know. So it's a lot of that's still up in the air. But I think we ought to focus on the things that we can do well, because our constituents deserve that.
What are you hoping for in this next session here?
Well, just to continue the work of being physically responsible,
yeah,
you know, in our state, that's a big one. And sort of a passion of mine, something I've been working on for about the last year and a half or 2 years, is dealing with the opioid addiction. The new Attorney General, Josh Stein, who I served with in the Senate, he's called me 3 or 4 times, and I've been met him personally since then to work on issues with regards to opioid addictions. You know, 4 of the top 10 cities in the United States that abuse opioids are in North Carolina. And Western North Carolina has a real problem. We have 33,000 people in the United States in 2015 died from opioid overdose. And so I've sort of taken that, since I'm, me and an optometrist are probably the closest to medical personnel in the Senate. So I'm really working hard on trying to address opioid addiction and the controlled substance reporting system, which will help us get the data that we need to address the problem. Opioid addiction, illegal drug use, they impact every aspect of every family in our lives. So there's no family that's immune from these kind of issues. And so we really need to work hard to get a handle on it, because it's a tremendous cost in human capital, but also in economic capital as well.
Well, Senator Davis, you know, I've invited you here twice. You've come in both times. I really appreciate that.
Certainly.
Thank you
Glad
so
to do it.
much.
Just, I really appreciate the opportunity to connect with your listeners.
Absolutely. All right. Well, anything else you wanted to address?
No, thank you. Just keep us in your prayers. We got a lot of stuff going.
All right. Sounds good. Senator Davis, thank you.